hello again. This is Captain Kevin Smith with you on Throttle Up Radio show and podcast. Now, we have our show on the weekends at Red State Talk Radio, and then we have a podcast on, well, it's on our website. You can find it at throttleupradio.com. Find all of our podcasts, and we have a bunch of them now. And you can also find it on iTunes, and there's a couple of other platforms that actually carry it as well. So, we are, again, we are in the midst of a special edition. We do these special editions from time to time. This is a kind of a long special edition. This is a multi-show extravaganza that is addressing itself to some of the key issues that we need to deal with in this time that we are living in. Now, keep in mind that Throttle Up Radio is not a political show. Throttle Up discusses things like critical thinking and how we can apply that in our daily lives so as to improve our ability to do things and to achieve mission success. We all want to be successful in our lives, and this is one of the ways that we can do it. We discuss this in many ways, in many shapes and forms, but the central focus here is critical thinking and the there's a companion initiative as well. It is called Complex Problem Solving. And now the reason why we're using those different phrases is more or less because we want it to be aligned with some of the language and some of the phraseology that exists today in this modern industrial world. But I didn't come up with it. If I had to come up with it, I would have called it something differently. But nevertheless, we have critical thinking, and a offshoot of that is complex problem solving. So you can think of it as an offshoot, as a more focused effort when we have to deal with things like judgment and making choices based upon some kind of informed decision that we have constructed in order for us to do so. So, we are in the midst of a special edition, and this is an offshoot, if you will, of critical thinking. It is called The Theory of Knowledge and The Theory of Truth. And like I said, this is an offshoot of critical thinking, and it is something that we also need to address ourselves to. Now, before we go on, I want to say something right up front about critical thinking. And that has to do with what's going on today in this world of ours. It is very, very confusing. It is very troubling to most of us. There are lots of things that are happening, lots of things that just recently happened that doesn't really make a lot of sense. We're not exactly sure what is occurring. We are, I guess you could say, we're a bit confused about things that are going on. We are even befuddled about things that are going on in our lives, in our communities, in our country as well. The first thing I'd like to talk about is, before we get into some of the specifics, the first thing I'd like to talk about is the fact that I think that we are on a collision course with destiny, because these are very unusual times. And it's my position that if you know how to think critically, then teach it to others. And I'm not saying that as something that is nice or something that is optional. I'm saying that as a definite requirement. Again, if you know how to think critically, then it is your obligation to teach it to others. We have no choice in the matter. If you don't know how to think critically, then learn. There's lots of ways that you can learn how to think critically. For one, and I'll give you a few things right off the bat. There's, of course, my book. It's called Critical Thinking Essentials. You can find it wherever fine books are sold. It's available at Amazon. It is also available in ebook format on Kindle. It is available at Barnes & Noble and other booksellers across the board. It's a handbook, and so it's easy to get through. It doesn't take a lot of time. I know we're all kind of busy. We don't have really a lot of time to read, but it is something that can be useful. It's designed to be useful for people on the go. It is a helpful tool for people on the go to come to grips with some key aspects of critical thinking so that we don't make mistakes. We don't make mistakes in the way we think. What we're talking about here is the theory of knowledge and the theory of truth. And let me phrase it in this way. First, we have thinking. Humans engage in thinking, and we're going to be talking about, in this case, not casual thinking or not casual doing. We're talking about when we are engaged in doing something meaningful. We have a meaningful purpose. And so how do we think when we are engaged in a meaningful activity, a purposeful activity? How do we think? There is thinking. There is reasoning, which is a form of thinking, but in the way I define it, a reasoning is a bit more focused than thinking. We engage in reasoning when we have when we're trying to achieve a favorable outcome. There's some key aspects of reasoning, particularly higher order reasoning, that comes to play. And then, of course, there's knowledge. We need to acquire knowledge, and we need to know how to acquire knowledge. And then, finally, truth. We need to know if something is true. Another way of saying that, and I said this in my last show as well, if somebody or some organization claims that something is true, how do we determine if that claim is accurate? How do we determine if a claim that something is true is in fact true? Is there a way for us to do that? It's my position that there is, but it's not well understood, and so we're going to try to deal with that in these shows, and we have been working in this area for quite some time. Excuse me. So we're trying to deal with that. And so what is it that we need to understand about truth? All right. And of course, there is that aspect of the theory of truth. But what we're trying to do here is we are trying to construct a truth algorithm. Why are we trying to do that? Well, because I think we ought to at least attempt to do so. It may not be perfect, but that's not the point. If we can organize our thinking in algorithmic terms, then maybe we can come up with a truth algorithm. We can come up with something that we can more or less activate, and it would help us walk through the process by which we can examine something and determine whether or not it is true, whether or not it satisfies some kind of a truth determining process. We call it the truth algorithm because it is based upon what I call algorithmic reasoning. Now, what is that? So, what is algorithmic reasoning? Well, it's algorithmic reasoning is a mental process. It is a disciplined way for our mental processes to engage themselves in a form and fashion, in a way, in a certain direction that we clarify and we understand certain conditions that have to be met in order for something to be true. What are those conditions? What are those specifications? What are the conditions by which we can determine if something is true or if something is not true? Now, this of course gets back into this whole area of thinking for ourselves. Do we want to think for ourselves, or do we want to have somebody else think for us? Now, we have been bombarded by so-called experts in this whole COVID-19 pandemic situation. Experts on top of experts have declared this and declared that and mandated this and mandated that because they can do so since they are considered by whomever, considered to be an expert in the field. But what does it take to be an expert? And that is something that we need to understand as thinking human beings. Maybe these experts are actually not experts, but they are claiming to be experts. All right, so the first order of business here then is, if somebody is claiming to be an expert, is that actually true? What is the truth of the matter if somebody is claiming to be an expert? How do we know that? Do they have some kind of certification? You can say, well, this person has a PhD in this particular discipline. Does that make that person an expert? This person has a medical degree, or this person is certified to be this or to be that. Okay, there is some validity to that, but who is it that is declaring these people to be experts? And the fact that they are, the fact that they want you to believe that they are experts, is that actually true? And if it is not true, then we need to consider what is the process by which we can determine if, in fact, something is true. Now, we are going to take we're going to take a look at something very, very specific, and it has to do with something that is called group psychosis. Group psychosis is something that is fairly prevalent and very, very serious, because if we are embroiled in group psychosis, then it is almost impossible for us to determine if something is true or if something is in fact not true. So we are going to listen to this audio clip. Again, it's from the Academy of Ideas folks, and it's good. It's called The Manufacturing of a Mass Psychosis: Can Sanity Return to an Insane World? And let us go ahead and listen to this audio clip.
The masses have never thirsted after truth. They turn aside from evidence that is not to their taste, preferring to deify error if error seduce them. Whoever can supply them with illusions is easily their master. Whoever attempts to destroy their illusions is always their victim. Diseases of the body can spread through a population and reach epidemic proportions, but so too can diseases of the mind. And of these epidemics of the latter variety, the mass psychosis is the most dangerous. During a mass psychosis, madness becomes the norm in a society, and delusionary beliefs spread like a contagion. But as delusions can take many forms, and as madness can manifest in countless ways, the specific manner in which a mass psychosis unfolds will differ based on the historical and cultural context of the infected society. In the past, mass psychoses have led to witch hunts, genocides, and even dancing manias. But in the modern era, it is the mass psychosis of totalitarianism that is the greatest threat. Totalitarianism, writes Arthur Verslewis, is the modern phenomenon of total centralized state power, coupled with the obliteration of individual human rights. In the totalized state, there are those in power, and there are the objectified masses, the victims. In a totalitarian society, the population is divided into two groups, the rulers and the ruled, and both groups undergo a pathological transformation. The rulers are elevated to an almost godlike status, which is diametrically opposed to our nature as imperfect beings who are easily corrupted by power. The masses, on the other hand, are transformed into the dependent subjects of these pathological rulers and take on a psychologically regressed and childlike status. Hannah Arendt, one of the 20th century's preeminent scholars of this form of rule, called totalitarianism an attempted transformation of human nature itself. But this attempted transformation only turns sound minds into sick minds, for as the Dutch medical doctor who studied the mental effects of living under totalitarianism wrote, "There is in fact much that is comparable between the strange reactions of the citizens of totalitarianism and their culture as a whole, on the one hand, and the reactions of the sick schizophrenic on the other. The social transformation that unfolds under totalitarianism is built upon and sustained by delusions. For only deluded men and women regress to the childlike status of obedient and submissive subjects and hand over complete control of their lives to politicians and bureaucrats. Only a deluded ruling class will believe that they possess the knowledge, wisdom, and acumen to completely control society in a top-down manner. And only when under the spell of delusions would anyone believe that a society composed of power-hungry rulers, on the one hand, and a psychologically regressed population, on the other, will lead to anything other than mass suffering and social ruin. But what triggers the psychosis of totalitarianism? As was explored in the previous video of this series, the mass psychosis of totalitarianism begins in a society's ruling class. The individuals that make up this class, be it politicians, bureaucrats, or crony capitalists, are very prone to delusions that augment their power, and no delusion is more attractive to the power-hungry than the delusion that they can and should control and dominate a society. When a ruling elite becomes possessed by a political ideology of this sort, be it communism, fascism, or technocracy, the next step is to induce a population into accepting their rule by infecting them with the mass psychosis of totalitarianism. This psychosis has been induced many times throughout history, and as Mirlu explains, it is simply a question of reorganizing and manipulating collective feelings in the proper way. The general method by which the members of a ruling elite can accomplish this end is called menticide, with the etymology of this word being a killing of the mind, and as Mirlu further explains. Menticide is an old crime against the human mind and spirit, but systematized anew. It is an organized system of psychological intervention and judicial perversion through which a ruling class can imprint their own opportunistic thoughts upon the minds of those they plan to use and destroy. Priming a population for the crime of menticide begins with the sowing of fear. For as was explored in the first video of this series, when an individual is flooded with negative emotions such as fear or anxiety, he or she is very susceptible to a descent into the delusions of madness. Threats, real, imagined, or fabricated, can be used to sow fear, but a particularly effective technique is to use waves of terror. Under this technique, the sowing of fear is staggered with periods of calm, but each of these periods of calm is followed by the manufacturing of an even more intense spell of fear, and on, the process goes. Or as Mirlu writes, "Each wave of terrorizing creates its effects more easily after a breathing spell than the one that preceded it, because people are still disturbed by their previous experience. Morality becomes lower and lower, and the psychological effects of each new propaganda campaign become stronger. It reaches a public already softened up." While fear primes a population for menticide, the use of propaganda to spread misinformation and to promote confusion with respect to the source of the threats and the nature of the crisis helps to break down the minds of the masses. Government officials and their lackeys in the media can use contradictory reports, nonsensical information, and even blatant lies, as the more they confuse, the less capable will a population be to cope with the crisis and diminish their fear in a rational and adaptive manner. Confusion, in other words, heightens the susceptibility of a descent into the delusions of totalitarianism. Or as Mirlu explains, "Logic can be met with logic, while illogic cannot. It confuses those who think straight. The big lie and monotonously repeated nonsense have more emotional appeal than logic and reason. While the people are still searching for a reasonable counterargument to the first lie, the totalitarians can assault them with another. Never before in history have such effective means existed to manipulate a society into the psychosis of totalitarianism. Smartphones and social media, television and the internet, all in conjunction with algorithms that quickly censor the flow of unwanted information, allow those in power to easily assault the minds of the masses. What is more, the addictive nature of these technologies means that many people voluntarily subject themselves to the ruling elite's propaganda with a remarkable frequency. Modern technology, explains Mirlu, teaches man to take for granted the world he is looking at. He takes no time to retreat and reflect. Technology lures him on, dropping him into its wheels and movements. No rest, no meditation, no reflection, no conversation. The senses are continually overloaded with stimuli. Man doesn't learn to question his world anymore. The screen offers him answers, ready-made. But there is a further step the would-be totalitarian rulers can take to increase the chance of a totalitarian psychosis, and this is to isolate the victims and to disrupt normal social interactions. When alone and lacking normal interactions with friends, family, and co-workers, an individual becomes far more susceptible to delusions for several reasons. Firstly, they lose contact with the corrective force of the positive example, for not everyone is tricked by the machinations of the ruling elite, and the individuals who see through the propaganda can help free others from the menticidal assault. If, however, isolation is enforced, the power of these positive examples greatly diminishes. But another reason that isolation increases the efficacy of menticide is because, like many other species, human beings are more easily conditioned into new patterns of thought and behavior when isolated. Or as Mirlu explains with regards to the physiologist Ivan Pavlov's work on behavioral conditioning, Pavlov made another significant discovery. The conditioned reflex could be developed most easily in a quiet laboratory with a minimum of disturbing stimuli. Every trainer of animals knows this from his own experience. Isolation and the patient repetition of stimuli are required to tame wild animals. The totalitarians have followed this rule. They know that they can condition their political victims most quickly if they are kept in isolation. Alone, confused, and battered by waves of terror, a population under an attack of menticide descends into a hopeless and vulnerable state. The never-ending stream of propaganda turns minds once capable of rational thought into playhouses of irrational forces. And with chaos swirling around them and within them, the masses crave a return to a more ordered world. The would-be totalitarians can now take the decisive step. They can offer a way out and a return to order in a world that seems to be moving rapidly in the opposite direction. But all this comes at a price. The masses must give up their freedom and cede control of all aspects of life to the ruling elite. They must relinquish their capacity to be self-reliant individuals who are responsible for their own lives and become submissive and obedient subjects. The masses, in other words, must descend into the delusions of the totalitarian psychosis. Totalitarianism, writes Mirlu, is man's escape from the fearful realities of life into the virtual womb of the leaders. The individual's actions are directed from this womb, from the inner sanctum. Man need no longer assume responsibility for his own life. The order and logic of the prenatal world reign. There is peace and silence, the peace of utter submission. But the order of a totalitarian world is a pathological order. By enforcing a strict conformity and requiring a blind obedience from the citizenry, totalitarianism rids the world of the spontaneity that produces many of life's joys and the creativity that drives society forward. The total control of this form of rule, no matter under what name it is branded, be it rule by scientists and doctors, politicians and bureaucrats, or a dictator, breeds stagnation, destruction, and death on a mass scale. And so perhaps the most important question facing the world is how can totalitarianism be prevented? And if a society has been induced into the early stages of this mass psychosis, can the effects be reversed? While one can never be sure of the prognosis of a collective madness, there are steps that can be taken to help effectuate a cure. This task, however, necessitates many different approaches from many different people. For just as the menticidal attack is multi-pronged, so too must be the counterattack. According to Carl Jung, for those of us who wish to help return sanity to an insane world, the first step is to bring order to our own minds and to live in a way that provides inspiration for others to follow. It is not for nothing that our age cries out for the Redeemer personality, for the one who can emancipate himself from the grip of the collective psychosis and save at least his own soul, who lights a beacon of hope for others, proclaiming that here is at least one man who has succeeded in extricating himself from the fatal identity with the group psyche. But assuming one is living in a manner free of the grip of the psychosis, there are further steps that can be taken. Information that counters the propaganda should be spread as far and as wide as possible, for the truth is more powerful than the fiction and falsities peddled by the would-be totalitarian rulers, and so their success is in part contingent on their ability to censor the free flow of information. Another tactic is to use humor and ridicule to delegitimize the ruling elite, or as Mirlu explains, we must learn to treat the demagogue and aspirant dictators in our midst with the weapon of ridicule. The demagogue himself is almost incapable of humor of any sort, and if we treat him with humor, he will begin to collapse. A tactic recommended by Vaclav Havel, a political dissident under Soviet communist rule, who later became president of Czechoslovakia, is the construction of what are called parallel structures. A parallel structure is any form of organization, business, institution, technology, or creative pursuit that exists physically within a totalitarian society, yet morally outside of it. In communist Czechoslovakia, Havel noted that these parallel structures were more effective at combating totalitarianism than political action. Furthermore, when enough parallel structures are created, a second culture, or parallel society, spontaneously forms and functions as an enclave of freedom and sanity within a totalitarian world. Or as Havel explains in his book, The Power of the Powerless. What else are parallel structures than an area where a different life can be lived? A life that is in harmony with its own aims, and which in turn structures itself in harmony with those aims. What else are those initial attempts at social self-organization than the efforts of a certain part of society to rid itself of the self-sustaining aspects of totalitarianism, and thus, to extricate itself radically from its involvement in the totalitarian system? But above all else, what is required to prevent a full descent into the madness of totalitarianism is action by as many people as possible. For just as the ruling elite do not sit around passively, but instead take deliberate steps to increase their power, so too an active and concerted effort must be made to move the world back in the direction of freedom. This can be an immense challenge in a world falling prey to the delusions of totalitarianism, but as Thomas Paine noted, tyranny, like hell, is not easily conquered. Yet we have this consolation with us, that the harder the conflict, the more glorious the triumph.
Okay, that's another great food for thought here that comes from us, to us, from the Academy of Ideas. Now, my audio engineer mentioned to me that we may have played this before recently, and that's okay. This stuff, some of it bears to be repeated as we go forward and try to understand better about how we can figure out, how we can determine if something is the truth. Let me give you a couple of examples here as we kind of solidify our thinking in this area. A few examples come to mind. One is climate change, man-caused climate change. The reason that climate is changing is because man is polluting the atmosphere with carbon dioxide and other gases. And that is being proposed as a scientifically determined fact, or that's being proposed as, in fact, being true. The other one is this virus that we have encountered, COVID-19 virus that we have encountered, is deadly enough for us to declare a worldwide emergency and declare that the world is facing a pandemic. That's another thing that is being proposed, and we are expected to believe that as something that is actually true. I could go on and on. There's lots of other things out there that we have encountered. Joe Biden was elected president of the United States through a fair election, and that is being proposed as being true. It's been certified by the Senate, of course, and all of that stuff, and we are expected to believe that this situation is in fact true, it's valid, it is accurate, and we should not question it because there are people out there that know this or that, and therefore it should be true. What I'm proposing here is that we determine whether or not something is true based upon our own ability to determine such a thing. I'm proposing here that we construct a truth algorithm. One of the branches of this truth algorithm happens to be whether or not we are living in a world in which we have encountered the manufacturing of a mass psychosis. Are we, in fact, dealing with a mass psychosis? Are we experiencing a mass psychosis? This occurs from time to time, and it's one of the things that we need to consider as we construct this thing that we call a truth algorithm. Are we living in a world that is this part of our reality? Has somebody been sowing fear? That's one of the keys to this. We need to know, and that is one of the branches that's either on or off, it's activated or it's not activated. Has somebody been sowing fear? With respect to the COVID-19 pandemic, if you recall that the initial models that were being used were forecasting a death rate in the United States exceeding 2 million in a very short period of time, with the worldwide death rate spiraling out of control, and it was going to be a economic and a human catastrophe, right? So there was fear across the board. Borders were closed. Businesses were closed down. Churches were shuttered. On and on and on. We were dealing with a mass psychosis. Was this real or was this manufactured? Was somebody sowing fear? So, all right, so that has to be determined, and that has to be something that we consider going forward. Is this something that we need to figure out? Is this something that we need to consider for the purposes of determining whether or not we are engaged in a mass psychosis, or whether or not we are engaged in something that, is this something that is manufactured or is it real? And here we have to determine whether or not there is credible evidence that this is in fact going on, that this is in fact real, that this is in fact the truth. Is there credible evidence? And the other thing is this. What does our intuition tell us? Now, intuition is a powerful tool. It's not well understood, and it's often neglected across the board because in some cases it's just not considered scientific, whatever that means. In some cases it is considered to be in the realm of superstition and so forth and so on. It's not any of that. Intuition is a human attribute, and we can in fact use it, employ our intuitive capabilities to help us understand the world around us, to help us understand our role, our position, our mission, if you will, in the world around us. Help us understand what is the best way for us to respond, what is the best way for us to live, what is the best way for us to work, and what is the best way for us to achieve something worthwhile. And our intuition can, in fact, play a role for us in this exercise, in this endeavor. Intuition is not normally considered to be a data point. Intuition is something that exists outside of the data that we collect. We don't measure it. We don't collect it. We don't consider it, and we don't honor it. But what does our intuition tell us? And one of the branches of the truth algorithm is, in fact, going to be, it is, in fact, in our construction, one of the branches is, in fact, intuition. Intuition, is there some kind of intuitive insight that we can consider going forward? Is it intuitive? Does this follow in a somewhat intuitive way that A plus B equals C, something like that? Is that intuitive? Okay, so let's take, for example, the recent presidential election. That's front and center. And let's say, okay, and we did this thought experiment before, but we're going to do it again. We're going to say, okay, given that one candidate did not campaign, and the other candidate did in fact campaign in a very substantial way, what is your intuition telling you about who is most likely to have won the presidential election? What is your intuition telling you is the most likely outcome? Is campaigning important? If it is, then how well that you do such a thing will have some effect on the outcome of the election, or is there no correlation between that and that? Is there no correlation between campaigning and the outcome of the election? The same thing with climate change. We can say, okay, is there a correlation or is there no correlation between what humans have been doing for a long period of time, which is humans have been creating fire. Humans have been fire makers in various ways. Humans have learned to create fire. Okay? Is that somehow correlated with a unhealthy change in the weather and the climate? Or is humans creating fire a natural part of our reality on this planet, and that the planet can take care of that in a meaningful and a effective way? Okay, so here we get into this idea, and it comes from our ability to be intuitive, is that are these things correlated in some fashion? Do they actually have some kind of ability to relate to one another? Or is everything out there just a one-off event? Is everything out there just isolated from everything else or not? Now, we live actually in a world. We live in a reality, if you will. We live in a universe, you could say, that is interconnected. So there is that factor. There is that reality that everything is in fact connected, and there is in fact some correlation that can be determined between two or more situations or two or more events as we go forward. Once we get three or more things going on, then we have entered the realm of what's called complexity. So we have entered a particular area of reality that exhibits complexity and uncertainty. Now, as we go forward, I want you to keep this in mind. And I think this is probably one of the most important things to consider. As we move forward in our ability to determine whether or not something is true by looking at the correlations between various things that have occurred or various things that are are being recognized as part of our model of reality. Is this correlation meaningful? Have things come together in some kind of a coherent way? And is our model of reality constructed coherently, utilizing our intuition first and foremost? Now, we can use other things as well, but we're going to start there. We're going to start with our intuition. We're going to say, is it intuitive that this thing actually has some meaningful effect on that thing, and together they produce an overall effect that may have some significant bearing on whether or not this particular thing is in fact true? If we are dealing with a effort to manufacture a mass psychosis, this is some artificial intrusion into our world, into our mind space, this sowing of fear. This is an artificial intrusion into our mind space. Somebody or some group wants us to be afraid, wants us to be very afraid. Why do they want us to be afraid? They want us to be afraid. They manufacture a collective psychosis so as to achieve some kind of end result that benefits themselves at the expense of everybody else. Okay, so that's about as far as we can go right now, and we are going to, I can see by the clock at the wall here that we are now coming to a close of another Throttle Up Radio show and podcast. And so now keep that in mind, all right, as we examine our ability to determine if something is true, as we consider the theory of truth as part of this whole effort to think critically, as we construct our truth algorithm, keep that in mind. Is somebody trying to sow fear into our lives in an artificial way? Is this proposition they are giving us, is it real or is it fake? Is it manufactured? Is it true? How do we know that this claim that they make, that this is true, how do we know that it is actually true? How do we know that truth is true? How do we know that something is false is false? How do we know that? Okay, so that's about as far as we can go. Again, Throttle Up Radio is with you every weekend on Red State Talk Radio. And we have a podcast that's always available. You can download that at your leisure, take it with you, and listen to it as you conduct your lives. Remember, think critically. That is one of the keys to our success in this world. Learn how to think critically, and we will see you all next week.